Exodus chapter 2, and we're going to be reading the first 10 verses. If you're following from one of the Bibles on the chairs, it's page 111. Exodus 2. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water."
Do sit down, and if you can get hold of a Bible, have a look at that passage, Exodus chapter 2, which Kath just read to us, and that's where we're going this morning. Well, this afternoon, as I do most Sunday afternoons, I plan to take my dog for a walk through Eastville Park and along the River Frome. And I expect to encounter other people and dogs, ducks on the lake, birds in the trees, and probably some squirrels. And the dog likes chasing the squirrels, so that's very good because it gets him exercised. That's what I expect. I will be very surprised if I come across anything like a small cardboard basket floating among the reeds at the edge of the river. And I should be even more surprised and shocked if I opened such a basket and discovered a crying baby inside. That would be a surprise. That would be rather worrying, actually. But that is exactly what Pharaoh's daughter discovered as she went for her wash in the River Nile, hopefully a bit cleaner than the Frome, one day around 3,500 years ago. It was certainly a surprise. But it was more than a surprise, because what she didn't know and had no way of guessing was that the baby in the basket she held in her hand was the one who would grow up to rescue his people from slavery, assuming she allowed him to live. The slavery that was imposed by her very own father, the Pharaoh. And in the story we're looking at this morning, we see God at work to deliver his people, but we see his plans to do that apparently hanging by a thread. Here we see God working out his plans in the most unexpected ways and through the most unlikely individuals. And in this story we find a God who is supremely faithful, a God who can safely be trusted, a God who is always for his people. Well, this morning is the third in our series in the book of Exodus, the second book in the Bible. Genesis, the first book, ended with Jacob and his family safely settled in Egypt. They've gone down there. They've been rescued from the deadly famine by Jacob's son Joseph. By the end of Genesis, both Jacob and Joseph have died, but their people carry on and they grow in number. They multiply dramatically. And as we move into Exodus, we find that their numbers are becoming worryingly large to the consternation of the new Pharaoh, who knows nothing about Joseph and all the good he's done for the country those many years before. And last week we looked at this new Pharaoh's response, as Simon explained last week. The historical background to this may well be the rise of a new kingly dynasty in Egypt. If you know anything at all about the ancient history of Egypt, you probably know that there's any number of different dynasties of kings and rulers who reigned one after the other. And it would seem that a new dynasty has arisen. That's why there's this ignorance of what's happened in the previous years. We can't be sure what names we should put to the various pharaohs who appear in these stories, though there are some fascinating possibilities, not least for the identity of Pharaoh's daughter who appears here in chapter 2, but you'll have to come and ask me about that afterwards. Anyway, this pharaoh responds to the alarming growth of the people of Israel, the Hebrew population, by a gradual ramping up of harsh treatments. Keep them under the heel of the Egyptian people. Beginning with propaganda, he soon moves on to imposing slavery and ultimately to attempted genocide. He attempts to involve the Hebrew midwives in his murderous scheme. And when that doesn't succeed, he issues a blanket instruction to all the Egyptians to destroy every baby boy born to the Israelites to ensure that in future this people will pose no threat to Egypt. It's a truly appalling situation, and it appears there is little or nothing standing between God's people and complete annihilation. In fact, the way this story is set out highlights what a desperately weak position the Israelites are in. On one side, Pharaoh, his army, and all the apparatus of government. On the other, a couple of midwives. It's not really an equal battle. And as we move into chapter 2 and today's episode of the story, that theme continues, because the human heroes here are a further succession of women. An Israelite mother, then her daughter, and finally, amazingly, the daughter of Pharaoh. And these three God will use. These three women who have no power in that world, people who are weak, he will work through them, whether they know it or not, to bring about what he wants to do. That's the story. Let's get into it. Here's the beginning, verses 1 and 2. Now, a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. Levi was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Eventually, his descendants will become the priestly tribe, and that's very important, but that still lies in the future. From among them now, a couple come together, marrying within the same clan as is normal. A good Israelite family is formed. Later in Exodus, we find out that their names are Amram and Jochebed. The account is compressed here. In the next few verses, we discover they already have an older daughter, and later on a brother is introduced as well. But the story focuses on this one baby, and what they're going to do when they find he is a boy, and the terrifying choice they're faced with. We're told he is a fine child. And probably that simply means he is healthy and strong. And unlike a lot of babies in ancient times, he has every chance of survival if only he's given the opportunity. And Jochebed resolves to do all in her power to give him that chance of life, in spite of that edict to destroy the baby boys. For 3 months he's hidden in the house. But the time comes when he can no longer be concealed. His cries are growing louder, and pretty soon he'll be mobile. He's still healthy, and so she makes a plan. Verses 3 and 4. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. In a sense, she's actually obeying the Pharaoh's command to throw the boys in the Nile, though Pharaoh didn't mention anything about putting them in baskets first. Papyrus is the species of rushes that grows along the Nile, and the Egyptians would use it for all kinds of things, including making the paper that they wrote on. This is what the first manuscripts of the Bible were written on, papyrus sheets glued together. It could even be used to make boats, though they must have been rather fragile boats. And there's nothing unusual about weaving papyrus into a basket, which Jochebed waterproofs by daubing it with these oily substances, a tar and pitch. And this will be the baby's home during the day. And at night, presumably, the plan is they will stealthily bring him home and hope that he will sleep quietly during the night. So the basket is placed among the reeds in the river, stuck there among the reeds. It shouldn't float away. It will be concealed from view. It will be shaded from the sun. And the baby's sister, Miriam, is posted to watch, probably to make sure the basket stays put. It doesn't sink or drift away. That's all great. But it's at this point that the plan begins to unravel. Along the bank of the Nile appears a most unwelcome procession. Pharaoh's daughter has arrived, along with a retinue who will guard her privacy as she goes down to bathe. Her presence represents an immediate threat, but worse still, she has spotted the basket and had it fetched. The tension rises. We watch with Miriam crouching in the reeds as Pharaoh's daughter grasps the basket with the baby inside. She opens it and discovers the baby boy. She sees at once that he is a Hebrew. By rights, at this point, she should turn the basket upside down and tip him into the river to drown. As easy as that. Gone. Forgotten. It's her father's command. But she doesn't do that. The baby is crying. More suspense. Will his cries appeal to her or repel her? The answer, she takes pity on him. And this is Miriam's big moment. She has watched these events closely. She has spotted the look on the woman's face. And she dives in with this astonishingly bold proposal. Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Point being, the baby still needs breastfeeding. That was understood. Well, talk about seizing the opportunity. Of course, this suggestion has the effect of nudging Pharaoh's daughter into allowing the baby to live. Miriam is offering her a ready-made solution. And unbeknown to her, it is the baby's own mother she goes to fetch. Now, just imagine that hurried conversation as Miriam bursts through the door. Mom, come quick, he's been found. I think it's Pharaoh's daughter, but don't worry, she wants to keep him. And I said I'd get someone to look after him and feed him. Don't look so shocked, Mum. It's you. Come on, move. Imagine the rapid succession of emotions that Jochebed feels as she gets her head around this news, stumbles out of the house and down to the river, receives her own baby out of the arms of the Egyptian princess, and gratefully carries him home. By the way, there's nothing implausible about Pharaoh's daughter and Jochebed and Miriam having a language in common, either Hebrew or more likely Egyptian. Subject peoples routinely have to learn their master's language in order to survive. And so the baby's life is assured. His own mother ends up getting paid to look after him. Instead of trying to hide him, she can be completely open. She can walk through the streets with the baby boy openly. His life is guaranteed. He has royal protection. Instead of being drowned in the Nile, he has emerged alive and saved from the Nile. The years go by. Finally, the day comes when Jochebed must take the boy to the palace and hand him over. How old is he now? We can't be sure, but the best guess is he's about 9 or 10 years old. The age when the formal training of a prince of Egypt is thought to have started. And only now we're told his name. Indeed, it may only be now that he gets his name. Verse 10, when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. At last the name of the great deliverer is revealed. And it's an interesting name. It sounds like the Hebrew for draw out. This is the child rescued from the water, the one rescued who will become the rescuer of his people, who will draw them out of Egypt himself. But the name element Mose is also found in many Egyptian names. It's quite likely that the pharaoh at this time is named Thutmose. There is a succession of three Thutmoses, Thutmose, 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 first, second, and the third, about this time, names of the pharaohs. And in Egyptian, the name Moses could mean child of the Nile. So it really is doubly appropriate for the young boy from the slave family who finds himself a prince of Egypt. Now, if you grew up going to church, you may well have heard this story and learned this story in Sunday school. And you might think of it as simply a good story with a happy ending. Sweet little baby, bizarrely rescued by exotic princess. Great story for kids. But there really is a lot more to it than that, as surely we've already seen this morning. This is no story for us simply to smile over before we head off for our Sunday lunch. In fact, this story poses two sharp questions to us. Questions which will rise repeatedly as we work our way on through Exodus. And these are the questions we're going to look at for a few minutes now. Question one. Who is your God? Who is your God? These Egyptians had many gods. Again, as Simon mentioned last week, the Nile itself was seen as a god. The Egyptians relied on the Nile for so much, water to drink and wash in, to provide fish to eat and to carry away refuse. More specifically, there was a god wonderfully named Hapi, H-A-P-I, who was the god of inundation, the annual flooding of the Nile, which was absolutely crucial for irrigating and fertilizing the fields. If you look closely at that picture, you'll see that Hapi's anatomy is rather interesting. He's a male god, but he also has breasts, and he also has a very large overhanging belly. That's because it's all about fertility. Well, the Egyptian gods were interesting combinations, often of male and female. But Hapi is the god of the inundation, the annual flooding of the Nile that brought that gave them the ability to grow crops and to look after livestock along that narrow strip along the River Nile. And they had songs to sing to Hapi. They would sacrifice to him so that he would provide the needed inundation every year. Even Pharaoh's command to throw the babies into the river might be connected with this sacrifice to the gods. And one of the great themes of Exodus in these early chapters is this titanic clash between the gods of Egypt and the God of the Israelites, the Hebrews. At this point, it has to be said, it seems that the gods of Egypt are doing pretty well. And the Israelites might well ask where their God has got to. You might wonder what that's got to do with us. Funny picture of an ancient god is on the screen. So what? The fact is, we all have gods. We don't all call them that, but we do. We all worship something. We might think we're so much more sophisticated than those people in ancient Egypt, with their sun god, Ra, and their frog gods, and their river gods, and all the rest of it. But actually, humanity hasn't moved on a millimeter since those days. In our culture, many people's god is simply the pursuit of pleasure. We too have a god named Hapi, H-A-P-P-Y. We are centered on ourselves. This quest for self-fulfillment that may be expressed through sex or food or alcohol or building the perfect home or pursuing a high-flying career that we think will fulfill us. And we may rationalize what we're doing, but really in all of this we are simply striving to satisfy our restlessness and feed our insatiable self. It's worship of ourselves, self at the center, that is the people we are, that is how we are made to worship. We are all worshippers. That's the point. And this passage poses the question, who is your God? In this story we've read this morning, there is a significant absence. God isn't mentioned once. And yet that doesn't mean he's not there. God is there, invisibly, behind the scenes. The narrator of the story knows that. God is there, orchestrating events, bringing these unlikely characters to encounter one another, raising up his deliverer, protecting him against genocide, indeed protecting the whole nation from genocide, because the story later makes it clear that there was no missing generation of boys and men. Pharaoh did not succeed. And Pharaoh's great mistake is that he leaves the true God out of his reckoning. His successor's great mistake will be to stick to his own God and refuse the claims of the one true God. And that decision will bring disaster on the nation of Egypt as the plagues fall, while the people of the one true God march out of slavery towards the promised land. So that's what the real God is up to. And there's the question for us. Who is your God? The second question follows on very closely. Can he be trusted? Can he be trusted? If this God of the Israelites, this God of the Bible, this God of the Lord Jesus Christ really is the true God, is it worth following him? Is there any point? Can he be relied on to do anything for us? That's the kind of question we might be asking. It's certainly the question that many of the Israelites, God's own people, would be asking as they suffered the assaults of slavery and murder. Well, look at Amram and Jochebed. The New Testament gives us another insight into this story, as the New Testament so often does. Hebrews chapter 11 is a gallery of Old Testament heroes of faith. And in Hebrews 11:23 we find this. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. And I'm sure we'll return to that chapter in Hebrews about the heroes of faith, because it goes on to talk about Moses and his faith. But this verse makes it clear that what Amram and Jochebed did, they did by faith in God. They saw something in this baby above and beyond what parents always see in their newborn babies. This was more than that pride and joy which parents usually feel. They had some kind of sense, and we don't know how, that God was at work here. And they knew about Pharaoh's edict, and they made a deliberate decision by faith to hide him for 3 months and then to commit him to the Nile. Now, people have argued over what exactly was in Jochebed's mind when she placed the baby there in the reeds. Whether it was her hope that he would be found by some sympathetic Egyptian, if there was such a thing, or, as I think, much more likely, that he would remain concealed, and that was the plan. But either way, this was an exercise of faith, even when they did not understand what God was doing or why. And what was the basis of that faith, we might well ask? What did they have to go on? Well, their faith was based on the promises God had made in the past, and which they confidently believed he was carrying out, and he would carry out. Promises like this one that God made to Jacob, or Israel as he became known, to reassure him when he set out on the journey down to Egypt. Genesis 46 verses 1 to 4. This is what God tells Jacob, Israel, to reassure him as he goes down to Egypt. So Israel set out with all that was his, and when he reached Beersheba, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in a vision at night and said, "Jacob, Jacob, here I am," he replied. "I am God, the God of your father," he said. "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes." So they reasoned, Well, God promised he would be with his people. He has promised to be with us, and therefore he will be with us. However gruesome and awful this situation is that we find ourselves in, he is with us because he's promised that he is. Or even further back, when God spoke to Abraham in Genesis 15, 13 and 14. This is the Lord speaking to Abraham, and the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and ill-treated for 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions." 400 years is a long time to wait. And at this point it wasn't over yet. But there's the promise. I will bring the people out, and by then they will be prosperous. Well, it doesn't look like it right now, Lord. But you said you were going to do it, and we're going to believe what you have promised. This is what Amram and Jochebed are doing. They are exercising faith in the promises. And the message of the whole of Exodus is that God can be trusted. Moses being rescued here is only the first step in what God is going to do. The point is, he knows what he is doing. He is keeping his promises. He is doing what he has committed himself to do. And he always does. In the end, 80 years later, it is Moses himself, under God, who leads his nation out of Egypt, out of slavery, and to the brink of the promised land. But for now, that still lies far in the future. Now, you may feel you are in some similarly hopeless situation today. Or there might be some specific situation that is eating you up with anxiety and you can't see your way out of. Something in your family, something that you are so worried about, a person, an individual, it's on your mind. Situation at work, worries about money, whatever it might be, the message is God can be trusted. He knows what he's doing. And if you have committed yourself to him, and you said, "Yes, I belong to him, I'm part of this family, I'm united with Christ," then rest assured of this: God is working out his purposes in your life and in this situation that you're worried about right now. Quite possibly he's doing that invisibly, as he does in this story. You can't see what he is doing, and you can only guess how he will work it out. Sometimes it's a mistake to try and guess, by the way. Don't try and outthink God. He has his own plans, he has his own ways of working. They'll often surprise us. The great thing, he is sovereign. He's the ruler. He's the ruler of our lives. We belong to him. He's working out his purposes in each of our lives. And the message of the Bible and the message of Exodus is this: if it's on a grand scale, God can be trusted. In Exodus, even though at this point his plans seem to be hanging by a very thin thread, there is a single vulnerable baby held in the arms of his enemies. One twitch of her hands and he's gone and he's dead and that's it. That's how thin the thread is. God even saved an entire nation. Or whether it's on the smaller scale of our own individual lives, God can be trusted. Now the question becomes, are you going to trust him with that? With that person? With that situation? With that anxiety? Are you prepared to hand it over to him and say, "Yes, Lord, I trust in you because I understand what you're like, that you are great and that you're faithful and you love me, that you promise to love me and you promise to work all things for good in my life because I belong to you and I love you. Yes, Lord, I trust in you. Absolutely, I trust in you to work for good, for my good and for your glory in this situation I'm struggling with." And if you will do that, then like Jochebed and Amram and Miriam, You make yourself available to the Lord for him to take his plans forward through you. This story doesn't end with Moses and his family, of course. The story moves on. Moses himself foreshadows another deliverer God would send to his people. 1500 years later, there was another baby. Another baby boy lying in a basket, lying in a manger. There was another king attempting to annihilate him by wiping out all the baby boys in the neighbourhoods. This king was not Pharaoh, but Herod the Great. This baby also miraculously escaped the slaughter with his life. And he too ended up in Egypt and eventually came out of there to rescue his people. Moses foreshadows the Lord Jesus in many ways, as we will see in coming weeks. Moses led his people out of their slavery. Jesus came to lead his people out of the slavery and power of sin. And that was a far greater rescue. That's the rescue that we all need. That's not just the rescue for one nation at one point in history. That is the rescue plan that is on offer to every man, woman, and child throughout history and across the world. And Jesus accomplished that great rescue by dying on a wooden cross. The true evidence that God keeps his promises, that he can be trusted, that everything God has promised to do, he will do. And he didn't do it invisibly, he did it very visibly and clearly and in public while people were watching. Jesus died there. His blood was poured out. The proof that God can be trusted in what matters most of all. On the cross, Jesus died in place of offenders and rebels like us. We can new life in freedom and security. So the final question is this: do you know him? Do you know the one true God through Jesus Christ, who has perfectly revealed him? Have you come to that place of admitting, yes, you are the true God. Yes, you are my God. Yes, you can be trusted. Yes, I am a sinner and a failure, and I need you to forgive me and take over control right here. And I'm giving myself over to you. You're in charge. I'm going to spend a few minutes reflecting on that message, and Dave's going to come back and help us in that.